Well, good morning. This is the first day of our June, our winter session in 2014. And yeah, it's good to be back. The inner session is a rare opportunity, even though it comes around every six months, but
you never quite know whether
you're going to have the opportunity to do session or to do it again. And so I guess the first thing I can't wait to say is really to grasp, you know, grasp this opportunity to use it well. And because especially if we've been doing a few, then sometimes we kind of think we know the ropes and how to manage our way through session and take it easy to a certain extent, but it is very rare in a jewel of a practice, so we want to use it well. So just to go through the basics, because sometimes during a standard retreat where we don't talk to each other and we sometimes get a little bit confused about what we're supposed to be doing, because it's like a cow going into a very vast field with no fences in sight, and it can be a bit overwhelming. And so, but the basic instruction for the session is just to pay attention, and pay attention is not so much as doing, but it's like a not doing. In Sesshin, in our practice, a main practice that we can do is not to do. In other words, the things that what we don't do is we practice not habitually thinking, our basic habit patterns of thought and conceptualizing and ruminating and all those kinds of things that we do as our normal bread and butter daily life. And by doing that, then attention, that's definition, I guess, of attention. Attention doesn't arise, it's just what is when we practice letting go of thought. And so whether it's during Zazen, when we have little, you know, tools for helping us do that, which might be physical sensations like breathing. So that's a very common Buddhist practice, is to pay attention to breathing or to come back to breathing. And that physical sensation of breath entering and leaving the body, so we allow our mind to rest on that, and when the mind, as it does, drifts off, whether we encourage it or it just does it itself, then when we notice that, then just breathing in and then coming back to that physicality of this moment. And pretty much that's any kind of practice, that whether it's kind of a broad awareness practice like Shikan Taza, where it's you know, you're allowing the sounds, the smells, the sights to fill your mind, then that's what happens when you bring yourself back, is suddenly that porous nature of being, unfixed nature, appears. And the fixed nature arises because of thought. You know, that when we think, Descartes says, I think, therefore I am. In that sense, it's like when thought arises, then therefore we have you and me and up and down. But when thought slows down, then we start to see that the so-called me is composed of trees and rocks and pain and joy and shit and stars. But the only dividing line is the activity of mind. So, although it sounds kind of a bit cosmic, it is. So to use the shin well, then you know the real basics. So the posture. So just being aware of how we're sitting. You know, I'm not a great believer in pain as being a good teaching tool. I mean, we're going to feel discomfort during session just because it's kind of new. We don't do it that extended sitting that often. But you try to be as comfortable as possible. Normally, that's kind of not through this kind of chilling, you know, but through having a nice straight back and being aware of where your head is sitting, so we don't have to hold it up too much. It's that extension through the top of the head, down the spine to drop. And relaxing the shoulders. Tucking the chin in slightly. And then, you know, if during session you need to, if you're sitting cross-legged and you need to switch to a kneeling position, then yeah, please do that. If you are feeling quite a bit of discomfort and you want to sit in the chair, then yeah, please feel encouraged to do that too. So that, because a certain amount of pain is instructive, it kind of keeps us awake, but I think beyond a certain point, just the reptilian brain goes, this isn't right. And it just becomes distracting. In that case, you know, I don't think there's any merit from suffering. So it's about effort, not kind of gripping effort, but that effort to be awake, to commit to letting thoughts go, and that constancy. So that's that we commit to doing it again and again, with that repetition. But also be kind to yourself. And that means that you notice that you're beating yourself up, you know, and then allow that to go as well. And be kind to others. So, you know, we all have opinions about each other when we're not talking to each other. And so notice those. And then just to be aware of our effect also on other people. So in how you carry yourself, how you relate to others, even though it's a non-talking way. You know, it's like we don't get so focused on doing this thing that, you know, we don't pay attention to how we're relating to other people and what their wants and needs are. I thought today I just want to talk a bit about suffering. And I kind of know if you've been around Buddhist practice for a while that the first ever talk that the Buddha gave was about suffering. And it's a great way to start, you know, a worldwide religion. It's all pain, man. Advertising execs these days, no shucky idiots. Not going to work on Facebook. his first talk, so we're told anyway, was about the Four Noble Truths, and the Four Noble Truths being the truth of suffering, the cause of suffering, the path that the end of suffering and the path that leads from suffering. And it's kind of interesting because it's like the I see some people say the first noble truth of life is suffering. I don't know where that comes from, but it's kind of prevalent in particularly my tradition in the early days, and it's just totally wrong kind of translation. But the words were really just the truth of suffering. And the truth of suffering is that the suffering is a fact. Discomfort or disquiet or dissatisfaction is a fact, and the thing that really brings us to practice really is mostly around that suffering is kind of a bit of a heavy word, but it's like just dissatisfaction and discomfort. Something's missing, and so that's what brings us to seek some kind of solution to that, and we don't know what that is. We don't know quite why and what's missing, you know, but we do want to find out, and that's the driving force for practice. So and why did the Buddha start off with that? And I guess it's because that's almost the ground of our questioning, our kind of what's this about? What can I do about it? And it's the and it's kind of also the root, kind of the root cause for all kinds of not only in our own life but externally, you know, that's happening in the world, human beings anyway, is that that leads to all kind of kind of perverse outcomes, you know, where we react to gain something that we think we're lacking, and you can see it all in our own lives and our others' lives, in the clash of nations, and that we all want something different, and that's kind of the root cause of that suffering that we are lacking, something that we don't have, we need to get. And therefore we do things to do that. There's kind of a real feeling of gap or lack. And so that's why the Buddha brought it up first off, is that if we don't acknowledge or pay attention to this, then you can't go straight from zero to hero. And you can't leap over this kind of stuff and go straight to nirvana. You know, it's like a straight to heaven, or, you know, it's like these kind of long roads that lead. And so the fact is that the suffering is our life, and so you shouldn't avoid it. So again, the Buddha started this great train of Buddhism, 2,500 years of Buddhism, with suffering. And his advice was to get close to it, just get alongside it, to know it, to become really intimate with your kind of angst and dissatisfaction. I had a colleague who, and she went to a 10-day Vipassana retreat. And she said, I don't get it. You know, when I got there, they said this thing like, you know, life is all about suffering. And I was like, I wasn't suffering. And it was true. You know, in that sense that kind of suffering is, there are all kinds of suffering. To say it is a specific way or a specific type of thing, it's not quite right. But if we pay attention to the thing that's moving us from appreciating our life just now, and it's always just now, there's never any other time, there's always some level of discomfort or dissatisfaction or wanting something apart from what we have now. And that's kind of the issue with us, is that we only have what we've got now. We only are what we are. And so that it's a mind factor to think that we're going to be something apart from what we are. And yet, we try that. So the Buddha starts off with this, you know, talk to the five arhats who he'd been practicing with, and he has his awakening under the Bodhi tree, and then approaches them, and then preaches his first lion's roar, his first talk, Dharma talk, and teaches the truth of suffering. And his friends, the ascetics, really, you know, heard something in it, and really appreciated his talk, and that's become, because the foundation for all Buddhist sects, So, but okay, but then that's on one side, and then we go to the Heart Sutra, which we chant every morning, and then start saying, start talking about no suffering, which seems a bit weird. So we say, we all go through this no. We moo everything, as a Japanese scholar once said. First of all, you moo everything. Moo means not. So we go through the no eye, no nose, no colour, no realm of sight, no ignorance, no old age and death. That's ridiculous. And then he says, no suffering, no cause of suffering, no extinguishing, no past. A total negation of the Buddha's first sermon. And no wisdom, no gain, no gain. It's like, oh God, where are we going with this? And thus the Bodhisattva lives Prajnaparamita. So this this discourse by the Buddha, which is, this is a discourse from Avalokiteshvara, talks about this other kind of truth, in that when the Buddha talks about suffering, he's talking about a kind of a, what we call like a relative truth. And relative truth is this world that we live in, like this. We suffer, we die, we get sick. You know, there's no way to escape these things. And yet, there's this other truth which we also experience or get inklings from time to time, of this no suffering, no cause of suffering, no extinguishing, no path, and no old age and death, no sickness. And that's kind of the thing which probably brings us, a lot of us, to Zen. It's like, oh, what's that? What's this no old age and death? What is this no sickness? Sounds pretty good. And so one side we're encouraged to get intimate with our suffering, and in that stuff, to get intimate with your suffering is again to not let the let yourself create some alternate reality with through thinking, and then to be intimate with what's coming up for you, which means when something uncomfortable arises, then to be allow that to be there. And you don't need to analyse the solution for it, but just to allow it to be there. And the reason we do that is because that's our life, directly. And that is a fact, just like anything else. When we do that, we appreciate that is just as it is, like a flower that's arising. And also it changes our total relationship to that. And that we don't over time, see it as something that needs to be got rid of. So the analogy that Thich Nhat Hanh uses is kind of talking about these two kind of truths, like suffering and no suffering, is he uses a nice analogy of like a wave in the ocean, in that so you have a wave, you know, you're a wave, and you're a really good-looking wave. And you look around and you see a whole bunch of other good-looking waves and some not-so-good-looking waves. and there are big waves, little waves. And you're hanging out being a wave, and then you see some of the other waves are starting to fade back into the water. Shit! That wave is dying. And then you see another wave being created. And you go, I'm going to die. And you get all kind of concerned about this, and then you know, you can preen yourself and then look at other waves better than you, and better time over that wave party and all that kind of stuff. And then and that's our life in that certain sense of that kind of wave life of just that's kind of your relative side of that. These are all truths to a certain extent that we are different. But the fact we miss is the fact that is our water nature. That is that true absolute aspect to ourselves that is has no life or death. That's we arise. And with the act of our arising arises consciousness, and then where its very nature, it has all this kind of stuff of suffering and life and death and all this kind of stuff. And yet, when we let go of thought, then we appreciate that vastness of that, you know, that too is, part of my ear. It is my ear. When you look at the stars, that's your eye. You know, that vastness or porousness of being. And so, in that sense, it's kind of that suffering to maintain that wave nature can be relaxed. And so then death becomes just a moment of itself, and life is a moment of itself. And we practice kind of letting go of that grip on this kind of form that is only one aspect of our experience. And embracing both these aspects, it doesn't mean we jump in and just go, oh, no suffering, that's the thing, that's what we want to go for. It's all God, it's all Buddha, it's all, because that's kind of suffering in itself as well too. So that really is what the practice is about, and this true nature, when we talk about true nature or no nature, it doesn't mean that there's an untrue nature as well, which we tend to think that sometimes we want to get away from this and go live on a mountain and just commune with nature or God but there's only one aspect of it. You know, you get hungry, you need to feed yourself. You get lonely, you need to talk with someone. It's interesting, some of the more traditional cultures, the connection with ancestors, and you very much have that in Zen too, because Pashupas comes out of the Chinese heritage, but that kind of vastness of lineage, you know, going back to wherever, and also forward or circular, so that not only do we have human ancestors, but, you know, we also have sky ancestors, sea ancestors, earth ancestors, and that recognition that all that we are is encapsulated or formed by all that. So our place in the world isn't kind of one person just happened to be here and here I am, separate from all things. So that's really being unfolded by life. And so, in terms of our practice, when we look deeply into this relative truth, for us relative truth is this feeling of dissatisfaction, or it could be a feeling of joy, but it's basically whatever is coming up for us. And so when we pay attention to that, allow ourselves to be intimate with that relative truth, then we start to have an appreciation, an intimacy with the absolute truth that also, when we get intimate with this experience, let go of thought, then that kind of vast nature, our vast nature, becomes apparent. And that's, Zazen. And Peter Matheson, who recently died, was a Dharma uncle of mine or Dharma cousin, but he's an interesting guy, because he was a Zen teacher per se, but he was probably one of the worst Zen teachers. Because he didn't really like teaching. You had the Zendo up in Sagaponack and in Long Island in New York, which was, and he, most of the time he liked to be, you know, flitting around the world, writing books and watching for snow leopards and things like that. So he was like a real activist in that sense, and a writer and creator. So, and so he just describes in that, there's a lovely book by his, it's called Nine-Headed Dragon River, which is kind of like his travels in Japan with Bernie Roshi Tetsugin and Maizumi Roshi, I think, and around various kind of Zen temples, kind of the pilgrimage, and disperses, he drops all these bits in there about from the snow leopard, and so it kind of, and I guess when he'd done the snow leopards before, he kind of converted to Zen. And there's that description, like in the snow leopard, where there really are, to see the snow leopard, you just have to sit and wait, like any kind of good ornithologist, and the amount of time they just sat like rocks on the mountainside waiting for this leopard to appear. You know, so there's that kind of sense of, and that's like a sense of, like with Zazen, it's like that, a nice way to practice it is by that kind of sense of, it's not so much maybe expectancy to a certain sense, but I guess it's kind of openness to what arises. You know, while we're kind of waiting for the snow leopard, you know, a whole bunch of other stuff comes up, like discomfort. Well, that's not the snow leopard. All kinds of things. You know, and that's the jewel in itself, you know. The snow leopard might arrive, you know. But it also presents, that snow leopard, you know, presents itself in all kinds of forms. You know, that's right here is the glass of water and the heat of the fire. And we know this during Sesshin, that's what we practice, is that. So, whatever you feel, whatever's going on, that's your life. You know, it's 100%, there's kind of no way out. You know, practice again is to let go of that struggle to try and find a solution. Because, you know, this is the solution. So over the next, today, I think, three days, I just encourage, you know, all of us to really use that time well. And to do the basics, and by doing that basics and having that certain kind of, you know, tension and inquisitiveness and openness, then that you know, that natural world, that true nature of ours, you know, becomes apparent.